From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the coercive tactics the military has used to purge gays from its ranks. We talk with Randy Schultz, author of the new book Conduct Unbecoming, Gays and Lesbians in the Military. The Middle East peace talks are set to resume next week. We'll talk with Andrew Whitley, director of Middle East Watch, about human rights issues in Israel and the occupied territories. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead pays tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. She turned 75 this Sunday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Clinton is nearing his 100th day in office, and he defended the progress of his administration today at his second White House news conference. The president told reporters that he misjudged the strength of Senate Republican opposition to his job stimulus package and said he should have had a plan to deal with unified Republican resistance. He also reacted to criticism from Ross Perot, saying the Texas billionaire is finding fault with an economic program that's close to what Perot himself advocated during the presidential campaign. Today, Senate Minority Leader Bob Dole joined the rising chorus of voices in the Congress who are urging U.S. airstrikes against Serbian positions in Bosnia. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Dole said that many Senate Republicans oppose U.S. airstrikes, arguing that it would be difficult to isolate Serbian targets in the Bosnian terrain.
But if we can find isolated military targets, and I think we ought to go after them from the air, no ground troops, and we ought to give the other countries, obviously they have troops on the ground, they ought to have an opportunity to remove their troops.
Dole said if the U.S. doesn't act now, the conflict might spread throughout the Balkans. He also expressed support for a bipartisan group of 46 House members who wrote a letter to President Clinton urging him to use NATO air power and to arm Bosnian Muslims. In their letter, the House members told the president the United States cannot acquiesce in genocide in Bosnia. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
The Pentagon released a long completed report today on sexual abuse at the 1991 Tailhook Convention. The report implicated 117 officers for sexual offenses or conduct unbecoming an officer, and it found that 51 had later lied to investigators. President Clinton said today that he found the report very disturbing, but he cautioned that it shouldn't be taken as an indictment of the entire Navy. A new study released today says that poor women don't receive the frequent checkups needed to detect early signs of disease. The report was prepared by the Campaign for Women's Health. NPR's Joanne Silberner reports.
The study looked at 1,300 women on Medicaid, which pays for health care for poor women. About 40% of the women had failed to receive at least 3 of 5 tests in the past year, tests that would identify high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, breast cancer, and cervical cancer. These tests are important because they identify diseases in their early stages while they are still treatable. Testing often saves money in the long run since early treatment costs less than treatment for full-blown disease. The survey found that the women may not be aware of what they're missing. 80% of them rated their care as good or excellent. This is Joanne Silberner in Washington.
The Dow Industrial has lost 15 points today to close at 3,414. This is NPR. The Environmental Protection Agency issued a rule today banning the release of certain refrigerants that contribute to the depletion of the ozone. The new rule would prohibit chlorofluorocarbons and other ozone-depleting chemicals from being vented into the air when refrigerators or air conditioners are repaired or serviced. Ozone in the upper atmosphere blocks harmful ultraviolet radiation from the sun. The search for bodies continues at what remains of the Branch Davidian compound near Waco, Texas. Medical examiners said today that many of the bodies were so badly burned that even DNA studies may prove impossible. From Waco, Wade Goodwin reports.
48 bodies have thus far been recovered from the ruins of the Branch Davidian compound. Examiners must work in the midst of 1 million rounds of live ammunition, which are piled waist deep. Chief Medical Examiner Nizam Pirawani said that because of the extreme heat of the fire, identification will be difficult.
At least half of the bodies that I recall have only fragments of torso or extremities left. They've sustained very high intensity fire damage. We don't know what we will do to identify them as yet. We may have to resort to some DNA studies if possible. We don't know if the heat will destroy the DNA structure or not.
Kirwani said that contrary to earlier Justice Department reports, there is still no evidence that any of the bodies recovered thus far sustained gunshot wounds. For National Public Radio, I'm Wade Goodwin in Waco.
Union organizer Cesar Chavez was found dead today, apparently from natural causes. He was 66. Chavez was a founder of the United Farm Workers Union and the first to successfully organize migrant farm laborers. He led successful boycotts of table grapes and other farm produce sold by growers who opposed the unionization of their workers. Chavez first attracted attention in 1965 when the union struck table grape growers in California's San Joaquin Valley. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A huge gay march on Washington is planned for this Sunday. Organizers expect it to be the largest gay march ever. One issue that has galvanized homosexuals but divided the country is whether the ban on gays in the military should be lifted. My guest Randy Schultz is the author of a new history of gays and lesbians in the military called Conduct Unbecoming. Schultz is also the author of what many consider to be the definitive book about the AIDS crisis and the ban played on. Schultz writes for the San Francisco Chronicle and was the first openly gay journalist to write for a major daily newspaper. In 1981, there was a policy shift on gays in the military. Schultz says prior to that, gays were discharged for homosexual conduct. The new policy required the military to discharge people who demonstrated a propensity to engage in homosexual acts. In other words, you could get discharged for being gay or saying you were gay without having engaged in misconduct. Schultz says this policy stepped up what he describes as gay purges in the military.
The strategy became in the 1980s that rather than going after gay individuals, the purges would go after, you know, trying to get every gay person on a particular base or installation, and that's the real sad story of this whole tale of gays in the military is not that they kick people out, but the very draconian measures that they use to kick people out in executing this policy.
What are some of the methods that you came across in your research?
A very typical gay investigation will start out when a military investigative agency will get a tip that somebody's gay. And what they'll do is take this person, who very often is an extraordinarily frightened 19 or 20-year-old, they'll take them into a room, and then they'll say, well, we've got videotapes of you having sex. We know you've engaged in sodomy. We can send you to prison at Fort Leavenworth if you don't confess and if you don't name others. The naming others is the crucial component of how these purges are conducted. And since these people who they take in are very young and inexperienced, and they also tend to be patriotic, so they believe what government agents tell them, that these tactics are extremely effective. One tactic that was used in the 1980s is investigators will take a single mother into a small room and threaten her not only with prison, but say, we're going to go to child welfare authorities and have your child taken away from you if you do not first confess to being gay and then name others. And so very often these people crack. They'll give 6-7 names. Those 6 or 7 people are then taken into small rooms, subjected to the same kind of intimidation, and then they in turn give 6 or 7 more names. And so in no time, the military can get huge list of suspected gay people.
Now, you write that the hunt for lesbians in the military in the 1980s was an obsession, more of an obsession than it was with men?
Yes, clearly. If you look statistically, about 3 times as many women on a per capita basis are kicked out for being gay in the military than men are. In the 2 services that are most resistant to having women, which is the Navy and the Marine Corps, the numbers are even higher. In the Marine Corps, if you're a woman, you're 7 times as likely to be kicked out for being gay as if you're a man. I think this stems from the fact that the military was very resistant to having women at all, and they can't kick people out for being women, but they can kick people out for being gay. And so what you saw was basically most women were assumed to be lesbians if they were in the military, unless they could prove otherwise. And the regulation became a mechanism for this pandemic sexual harassment that women face in the armed forces. It was very, I can't tell you how many women I talked to who had colleagues or superiors within the military put the make on them and then basically say that if they didn't go to bed with the men, that they would the men would accuse them of being lesbians. And if a woman went and complained about sexual harassment and the man went and accused a woman of being lesbian, invariably the command structure never investigated the sexual harassment complaint, but did aggressively investigate the accusation of homosexuality.
There was something that you call the Paris Island Purge of 1988. What happened there?
This was in of a lesbian drill instructors in Paris Island, which is the only Marine Corps base where women are trained. And this was, again, you had the women who were singled out tended to be women who were in non-traditional jobs. And in this case, there were drill instructors, which is sort of the most macho of macho jobs in the Marine Corps. And what happened was it started with rumors that were being spread at different bases that there were a lot of lesbians at Paris Island. And so the Naval Investigative Service, apparently under the direction of the Marine Corps headquarters in Quantico, launched a very brutal series of interrogations. One woman was told her child would be taken away, and then she was locked in a room with her estranged husband who had beaten her and had a history of abuse. Other women one woman in particular, a corporal named Barbara Baum, it was believed by the Marine Corps brass that she knew the names of all kinds of lesbians, so she was court-martialed, and every step of the court-martial, she was told, if you name names, if you give us names of other lesbians, we won't court-martial you. She refused. She ended up being court-martialed, and she was sent to prison for consensual sex in the privacy of her own bedroom off base. She was sent to prison and continued to be pressured to give names. Ultimately, she did give 77 names to military investigators and with the promise that she would be released from prison. Of course, they did not release her from prison, and she was kept there. You had a situation, in essence, where somebody was put into prison until they named names of other gays, and that was her crime, and what she was in prison for was not naming the names of other lesbians. In the end, half of the women on that base were interrogated about suspected lesbians, and I think the Marine Corps lost 10% of its female drill instructors.
Randy Schultz is my guest, the author of the new book, Conduct Unbecoming Gays and Lesbians in the U.S. Military. What kind of explanation did you get from the military when you asked them about the purges of gays?
They would say, and somewhat dissembling, that that all they were doing was investigating possible violations of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, because the UCMJ does have a provision that provides for 5 years at hard labor for anyone who is convicted of sodomy. So they would say that they were merely exercising, you know, their legal duties in enforcing this code. What was somewhat dissembling about this, when I talked to the head of investigations for the Naval Investigative Service, I said, okay, you're enforcing the sodomy provision, and this provision in the law, in Article 125 of the UCMJ, is not written, it is written for both heterosexuals and homosexuals. You cannot basically participate in any sex other than missionary, you know, position sex between members of the opposite sex. And I said, okay, when was the last time you investigated a heterosexual for sodomy? And he had been there 6 years and could not recall a single case. So these laws are selectively enforced solely against gay people.
In looking at the history of gays and lesbians in the military, did you find that the rationales for keeping gays and lesbians out of the military changed over the decades?
Yes, the rationales have suited the times. At the beginning, in the 1940s, the original gay regulations were meant to be a compassionate response to the presence of gay people in the military. You see, it used to be, before World War II, that they'd just throw anybody in prison if they found out they were gay or if they could court-martial them for gay conduct. And then the concept with the new regulations in 1943 was that these people aren't criminals, they're sick, so we should deal with it as a medical problem. problem, and that's when they used the medical paradigm. During the McCarthy era in the 1950s, that was saw the creation of the whole concept that gay people were a threat to national security, and that was really totally created in the McCarthy era. And then in the more recent years, when the security risk argument doesn't really hold up, and it's difficult for the military to make credible arguments that gay people aren't fit to serve, the arguments have instead become, well, heterosexuals won't want to serve with gay people. They won't take orders. They won't want to be in the same foxholes. They won't want to share the same barracks with gay people. So now we're seeing the argument that it would disrupt the good order, discipline, and morale of the military to have gay people there.
In the, you know, the big issue now is if you said, cohesion of the troops. And one of the arguments you hear a lot is that romantic involvement has no place in war if there is a troop of men fighting in battle and one of them is lovers with another. There will be a special relationship that will undermine the democracy of the group and the cohesion of the group. You can't favor one person more than another. You can't be more concerned about one person's welfare more than another's in that kind of battle situation. What's your response to that?
Well, I think in those kind of situations with heterosexuals and they have married couples, I do not believe that married couples among heterosexuals are put in the same unit where that could be a factor. And I would expect that once gay people were allowed to serve, that they would have to have certain rules in order to limit that kind of interference with the group as well.
I guess, of course, the difference is there haven't been men and women together on the battlefield ever in American history.
Yeah.
Whereas there have been men together, so it would be possible for men to have a secret relationship with each other on the battleground.
I think these things, it could be possible, but I haven't heard that being raised as a huge issue.
I have, that's why I bring it up.
I have. Oh yeah, yeah. I haven't heard that. No, the it would just seem to me that you would, and especially I think in the near future where we're going to be seeing a lot of the lifting of the combat exclusion policies around women, and that both heterosexuals and gay soldiers are going to be facing these issues, and that it seems to me an appropriate area for the military to have regulations about.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about gays in the military. My guest is Randy Schultz, who's investigated the history of gays and lesbians in the military. His new book is called Conduct Unbecoming. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Randy Schultz is my guest. Randy, what do you think of the military's policy on AIDS and testing for HIV?
Actually, the military has done a very admirable job of dealing with the HIV epidemic. At the beginning, in the early 1980s, when the first people were coming down with AIDS in the military, their reaction was to, you know, try to kick them all out for being gay. And there are some very tragic stories of people who were not even well enough to sit up during their discharge hearings who were subjected to this kind of treatment. But once the military started testing every one of their troops in late 1985 and early 1986, first they found that a much larger number than they had predicted were testing positive, and those people testing positive, an awful lot of them were in very high-ranking, very sensitive positions. There were a lot of colonels who tested positive, a lot of people in military intelligence. And I think you had that factor added to the fact that the medical people in the medical branch of the military did not believe that it was right to be kicking people out. They always took a more compassionate approach to this, so that those factors ended up resulting in regulations in the military that provide for non-discrimination if you're HIV positive and for confidentiality of your medical records. If you are HIV positive, you are not allowed to go overseas or you're not allowed to participate in combat or be in a deployable unit. But that, I think there's a rationale for that that makes sense. You know, you don't want people on the battlefield bleeding when they could, you know, if they're HIV positive. But on the whole, these regulations have been, people are allowed to stay in, and these regulations have been very well enforced.
You write that in the past decade, gays have served as generals in every branch of the armed forces. The
yes.
Marine Corps had at least one gay person in a four-star rank since 1981.
And so did the Army.
Now, you don't mention who they are, and I'm not asking you to mention
yeah.
who they are, but I'm wondering if you've been tempted to out them and what your personal policy as a journalist investigating this issue is on that.
Yeah, I don't believe in outing as a rule, except in cases where there's, egregious hypocrisy. And I feel if you're going to out somebody, you need on-the-record sources, people who will say with their names that they know as a fact that this person is gay. With one of the generals, was not engaged in this kind of hypocrisy. There was another general, one of the four-star generals, who actually was in charge of a branch of the service that had one of the most brutal lesbian witch hunts in the 1980s. And I would have outed him had I had on-the-record sources, basically on the criteria of hypocrisy. But I didn't have those sources, and I didn't want the book discussion to be changed into a discussion of outing and whether I was right or wrong to do it. So I didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't out him by name.
Right. You've been following the congressional debate, no doubt, on gays in the military. What has struck you most about it?
I think what's struck me the most about the congressional hearings is how appallingly ignorant both the senators and the experts are about the reality of gay people in the military. That sort of watching these experts try to inform the senators is like watching the blind leading the blind, deaf, and dumb. These experts know very little. They may know about rules and regulations, but they clearly have not talked to hardly anyone who is gay in the military, so that they don't have any. So what they say is a lot of just fiction. The whole issue of how the military conducts these witch hunts and these purges has been completely neglected. And I feel in this case that even people who support the policy would be, flabbergasted if they knew what the military does. And the cruel ways that they use, to enforce this policy.
Do you think that President Clinton is backing down on his promise to overturn the ban on gays in the military?
No, I think the president indicated last week when he met with gay leaders that he absolutely was going to lift the ban on gays in the military. And so then the controversy will go to Congress where they could vote to reenact the ban as part of a piece of legislation. But then they would almost need veto-proof majorities, which I think would be very difficult to obtain in both the House and the Senate.
You said that you learned a lot about the connection between the women's movement and the gay rights movement by researching this book. What did you find out?
Well, it was very interesting because intellectually I always knew there was a linkage between the gay movement and the women's movement, but it was fascinating to watch it played out in the lives of these people. What is this military regulation really all about? It's about manhood. It's about the confusing place that we are in American society now about the roles of men and the roles of women. The military is the one institution that guaranteed to do one thing beyond all else, and that was to take boys and make them into men. And the reason the military really has not wanted women, and the reason that women have been subjected to horrible sexual harassment in the military, is basically the same reason that the military doesn't want gay people, that the presence of women, the presence of gay people in the military is a threat to those individuals who have sought out this institution in a way to reinforce their own sense of manhood. And that's what it all gets down to. It's all about masculinity and manhood and having one last bastion where the traditional old-fashioned concepts of masculinity are still enshrined.
My guest is Randy Schultz, author of the new book, Conduct Unbecoming, Gays and Lesbians in the U.S. Military. Randy, you developed AIDS while you were researching your book on the military. Having written such an important book about AIDS, I wonder if you think that all the research that you've done is affecting your perception of your own condition and what it's like for you to be going through what you've written about so much.
Well, unfortunately, I know all about this disease inside out. And I had stopped basically writing about AIDS in 1990 because it was just too stressful. I live in the gay community of San Francisco, so you have to, everybody, most gay men are HIV positive here, and so you're dealing with your friends who might be getting sick. I was dealing with it professionally, and then I was dealing with it in my own life, and so it just became too much, and I basically had to stop writing about it because it was, I was starting to get psychosomatic symptoms and things of stress.
I remember when I interviewed you in, I guess it was 1987, after And the Band Played On came out.
Yeah.
You were telling me that on some of the TV interviews, people would say, and by the way, Randy Schultz, do you test positive for HIV? And you were just appalled that,
yes,
that people would just ask you about that, you know, in a public forum like that. As it turns out, you had tested positive at the time, and you decided to not mention it, which... a decision I'm not challenging at all. I'm just wondering what it was like for you to go through this kind of public display, being asked that all the time and not wanting to talk about it.
Well, it was weird. It's such a, I think heterosexuals don't have a lot of etiquette around that issue, because it is intensely private and it's not something that you necessarily want to talk about on national TV. And I just couldn't believe when people would just, you know, ask it like it's like asking me, you know, if it was a nice day or something, like they had a right to know. And so it was a very strange situation. My basic answer was, at that point and up until I disclosed recently, was that the only people who really have a right to know are people I was going to bed with. And that's to some extent how I feel about it. But then I got sick, and the news was going to get out anyway, and I felt it was important for me to disclose it as opposed to have other people do it for me.
Right. I'd like to ask you something about what I imagine was a really big change for you when you were young. I recently found out reading all these recent articles that have come out about you, that you are the president and founder of your local chapter of Young Americans for Freedom, which is a very conservative group.
Yes.
And I'm wondering what you were like as a young conservative.
Well, you know, I grew up in Aurora, Illinois, which was at that time extremely conservative part of the country. They had not elected or voted for a Democrat since like in over 100 years. And so that was sort of the ideas that I was exposed to. And then also I did what a lot of, I think, people do when they're in junior high and high school, and I read a lot of Ayn Rand, which still has an impact on me in that I'm a very strong individualist. I think that influenced my thinking in a very conservative direction. And I think that's been real good. I mean, I'm obviously not that conservative anymore. But I think with people on both ends of the political extreme, either the left or the right, there is a tendency to dehumanize the people with whom they disagree. And I feel real grateful that I had the opportunity to be exposed to a lot of very conservative people, because you can see that they, you know, most of them are just like people on the left, where they sincerely believe that what they're doing is right. They're not evil people. They're not malicious. They just, you know, they just have different points of view. So I think it was very helpful for me as a journalist, because it let me see the importance of being fair and being balanced in coverage.
Are you going to keep writing? Do you know what your next
subject is? Yeah, I'm going to start a column for the San Francisco Chronicle, where I've been on leave, and I'll start writing a column for them in June, and then I'm going to give myself a breather from books, just because I think you need time off between books so you have something new to say.
How are you dividing your time and energy between trying to really take care of yourself and not push too hard, between that and the journalist impulse to keep pushing to meet that deadline, to keep driving yourself as hard as possible?
This is a matter of great discussion between myself and my lover and my friends, because I'm basically a workaholic. Coming from the Midwest, I think I have that Protestant work ethic, and I have a real hard time slowing down. And basically, I think I made the decision several years ago that, you know, I could just sit around and sip cappuccino and coffee shops here in San Francisco, and perhaps live longer. But I'd rather, you know, have the life that I have be meaningful. And I find my meaning through my work. And so I'm probably going to keep on pushing.
This Sunday is a big gay march planned in Washington. What's the significance of that to you?
I think what's interesting is when I talk to people who are going, it's going to draw a much broader cross-section than any other gay march ever has. A lot of people who are never involved in politics are going to be at this march. And so I think it's meant to be a show of strength. And after the controversies around the military and then with the anti-gay campaigning that some of the Republicans did last year.
Well, Randy, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Randy Schultz is the author of the new book, Conduct Unbecoming, Gays and Lesbians in the U.S. Military. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Next week, the Middle East peace talks resume against a setting of increased violence and distrust between Palestinians and Israelis. Coming up, we talk with Andrew Whitley, director of Middle East Watch, about human rights issues and escalating violence in Israel and the occupied territories. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead pays tribute to Ella Fitzgerald. She turns 75 this Sunday. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. President Clinton held his second formal press conference today, offering his interpretation of his first major legislative defeat in Congress. NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
I feel I've spent a year here this week, is how Mr. Clinton summed up the recent string of setbacks and disappointments. The freshest defeat was the failure to get his economic stimulus package through Congress. The president said he regretted that the package didn't pass and that he'd been consulting with people in the White House and on Capitol Hill about what he could have done differently. He admitted to having misgauged the necessity to make a stronger case for the package with the public and for misjudging how tough it would be to peel off the 4 Republican votes he needed to get the package through the Senate. But the president downplayed the significance of the defeat, saying he wanted to put the stimulus package in a larger context. Mr. Clinton said he wanted to remind Americans that in his first 100 days in office, his administration had already fundamentally changed the direction of American government. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
Housing Secretary Henry Cisneros says President Clinton's 1994 budget will quadruple funding for homeless programs. Cisneros also announced today nearly $150 million in existing funds will go to permanent housing for the homeless. Cisneros said the Clinton plan includes first temporary shelter, then help with physical and social problems and job retraining, and finally permanent shelter for homeless people who begin to provide for themselves. President Clinton is under pressure from inside his administration and outside to take military action to end the war in Bosnia. NPR's Ted Clark reports.
Last Saturday, 12 desk officers in the State Department with daily responsibility for former Yugoslavia sent a letter to Secretary of State Warren Christopher, criticizing U.S. policy toward Bosnia as Western capitulation to Serbian aggression and calling for military intervention. Today, the New York Times reports that the U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, Madeleine Albright, has called for similar action. In recommendations released last week, the administration's top relief experts urged the use of outside force to protect civilians in Bosnia. State Department spokesman Richard Boucher said today Secretary Christopher welcomes dissident views among department employees.
That's a healthy process. That's something the secretary sees as important to the formulation of good policy, whatever he and the president decide to do.
President Clinton said today his review of policy toward Bosnia will be completed in the next several days. This is Ted Clark in Washington.
The Environmental Protection Agency says companies that repair air conditioners and refrigerators must recycle the chemicals that cool the appliances. The EPA declared today that firms must use new equipment to prevent escape of CFCs and other chemicals that deplete the Earth's ozone layer. The regulation is part of the Clean Air Act. The Dow Jones Industrials Average moved lower today, losing 15 points to close at 3413.77. This is NPR News. Russian President Boris Yeltsin today gave his vision for what type of government he'd support if Russian voters back him in this weekend's referendum. Yeltsin called for private land ownership, a stronger executive branch, and an American-style legislature. Meanwhile, Yeltsin's opponents staged a rally in Moscow today, More than 10,000 nationalist and pro-communist demonstrators marched, urging a vote against Yeltsin. The president, meanwhile, plans a nationwide TV speech tomorrow night to counter his opponents. So far, Yeltsin is doing well in public opinion polls. The Pentagon released its report today on sexual assault and misconduct by Navy and Marine officers at the 1991 Tailhook Convention in Las Vegas. 117 officers are implicated in the report, and another 51 are accused of lying to Pentagon investigators. NPR's John Greenberg has more.
Today's report details an atmosphere described as a free fire zone where officers felt they could act indiscriminately in matters of sexual conduct. The investigation by the Pentagon's Inspector General found that 83 women and 7 men were assaulted at the convention. The Navy and Marine Corps now are responsible for taking disciplinary or judicial action against specific officers. Admiral Frank Kelso, Chief of Naval Operations, says the scandal showed that some officers did not live up to naval standards of behavior.
Tailhook also brought to light the fact that we had an institutional problem in how we treated women. In that regard, it was a watershed event that has brought about cultural change.
Kelso said he hoped disciplinary actions would move ahead as quickly as possible. This is John Greenberg in Washington.
The World Health Organization today declared tuberculosis humanity's greatest killer and said the disease is out of control in many parts of the world. The organization said without immediate action, more than 30 million people will die from TB over the next decade. Officials called the disease an unnecessary tragedy. This is NPR News from Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The Middle East peace talks are set to resume next week. The Palestinians ended their boycott of the talks, although they had initially vowed not to go back to the table until the Palestinian deportees in southern Lebanon were allowed to return. Violence in Israel and the occupied territories escalated dramatically after the deportations. In late March, after 13 people, police, soldiers, civilians, and settlers, were killed by Palestinians, the Israeli government closed the occupied territories. Andrew Whitley has been monitoring the situation. He's the director of Middle East Watch, a division of the group Human Rights Watch. He says the peace talks have been undermined by the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Yes, they have. I think that the Israeli side hasn't helped by the deportations at the end of last year. It certainly hasn't helped by the closure of the occupied territories. The closure, which in the last 3 weeks has prevented most Palestinians from earning their livelihood and is facing and makes them face considerable hardship. From the Palestinian side, I think that the rising violence, which is not entirely attributable to the Palestine Liberation Organization or to other organized groups, has certainly made the climate harder. And I think that the overall climate is one, it's somewhat grimmer than it was 18 months ago when the peace talks first began in Madrid.
At the end of March, Israel closed off the occupied territories. You're one of the human rights groups that issued a statement condemning the indefinite closure. What are your reasons for condemning it?
Several grounds. We feel that the way in which the Israeli government had made the Palestinian economy in the West Bank and Gaza dependent on Israel over the previous 26 years meant that if they arbitrarily shut off the territories, then they were going to be throwing out tens of thousands of people from their livelihood and depriving the area of its principal source of the economy. In addition, we think that the consequence of the closure of Jerusalem hasn't been fully understood either in this country or else even in Israel, where people are simply not aware of the fact that the only modern roads run through Jerusalem. And that as a result of closing off the territories, what you in fact do is you divide the occupied region into 4 separate self-contained areas which can't contact each other. That's the northern part of the West Bank, the southern part, East Jerusalem, mainly Arab East Jerusalem, and the Gaza Strip, each of whom have had interconnections in the past, and East Jerusalem in particular, as the main focus for the Palestinians, as the area where most of their institutions are, medical or legal, or the foreign consulates if they want to be able to get assistance from there.
Israel is in one of the worst rounds of violence of the recent past. What are some of the things that have fed this new cycle of violence?
There's a sense of insecurity on both sides, so a sense that was very clear when I was in Israel in January, immediately after the deportations took place, so that the deportations and the violence that preceded it, the attacks by Palestinians on defenseless Israelis, mostly people who had no connection with the government or the security services, that these made Jews, on the one hand, feel very vulnerable in their own land, that they were liable to be attacked simply for being Jews. Palestinians, for their side, touched on their deepest fears of vulnerability at the hands of the occupying authorities, who could deport them at a moment's notice. So that act of deportation in late December went really to the quick of both communities' deepest psychological fears, and I think the reaction of the Israeli forces since then, using much tougher means to be able to get at the real culprits in the sense of armed men, has fed that further violence. It's largely unknown abroad that the Israeli security forces are using rocket-propelled grenades and other forms of military warfare in order to be able to demolish houses where people are allegedly holed up. There's a great deal of what the military euphemistically called collateral damage. In the Gaza Strip just a few days ago, there were more than 14 houses destroyed in the course of hunting for one little group.
In this cycle of violence, Israel says it has to take precautions against increasing attacks against Israelis. The Palestinians say they have no recourse but to violently protest growing oppression and human rights violations in the occupied territories. What is the role of a human rights group such as your group Middle East Watch in evaluating issues on both sides and evaluating what's happening in this increasing, you know, escalating cycle of violence?
We try and identify who are the parties who are responsible for certain actions. We do not take any position whatsoever on whether Palestinians have a right of resistance as people who are living in occupied territory or not. That is simply not our issue. What we do is we try and see who are the actors. If there is a particular group which has a chain of command and identifiable leadership that claims credit for an action, we will condemn it. We will attempt to systematically document what the pattern of actions is and to try to hold them to account to certain standards. When you're dealing with the occupied territories, the natural legal standard that you hold people up to is the Fourth Geneva Convention. That's recognized throughout the world. The Israelis recognize it de facto in spirit part of the time, but they don't consider themselves bound by it, in that they're virtually alone in the rest of the world, in both the legal community and the international governments. So those are the appropriate standards. They're the ones which we look to see whether Israeli behavior is matching what is required under the Geneva Conventions, and obviously collective punishment, which we referred to a minute ago, is one of them. Making sure that the economy of the region is not disastrous, it does not allow for the well-being and welfare of people is another issue. Certainly not deporting people, as has been their practice in the past. So when we look at violence, we try to distinguish between who is undertaking the action and for what purpose. If a Palestinian individual or a group were to claim credit for an attack on Israeli soldiers, for example, we would simply not take issue with the matter. But if, however, that Palestinian group were to capture a soldier and to kill him, as took place immediately before the deportation, it happened to be an off-duty policeman, in that case a border policeman, then certainly we condemn it. That's somebody who was hors de combat. He was not able to put up any resistance, and it's a plain, straightforward murder.
My guest is Andrew Whitley, director of Middle East Watch. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Andrew Whitley, director of the human rights group Middle East Watch. There are still 396 Palestinians who are living in that no man's land, the Palestinians who were deported from Israel. What are the conditions of the deported Palestinians now, and what is your group in the middle of trying to do now?
The issue has rather faded from the scene, in part because the deportees have considerably improved their living conditions. The weather has obviously improved. They are not in danger of losing their lives from starvation or from lack of water, from dehydration. That although the Lebanese government officially does not allow supplies to reach them, in practice adequate food supplies have been smuggled to them. We're particularly concerned about the issue of regular and frequent access by the ICRC, the International Committee of the Red Cross, which is the principal body that obviously has the means to be able to determine the well-being of these people, who are still considered under international law as protected persons. We continue to take the view that any partial solutions are inappropriate, that the deportation was illegal in the first place, and that therefore the Israeli government ought to take everybody back, and then if they have specific charges against them, bring them before a court.
Israel has said that it's hypocritical of Arab countries to criticize Israel for its deportation of the Palestinians. Egypt, for instance, is in the middle of quite a crackdown against militant Islamic groups. Do you think it's hypocritical for Arab countries to criticize Israel?
There are always issues of double standards. The main argument that's been used by the Israelis, which is a fallacious one, is that Kuwait expelled thousands of Palestinians without any murmur from the international community. They're wrong on two counts. First of all, there was an uproar on the part of the international community. Our organization, with its own small voice, was particularly vigorous on this issue. And secondly, they're wrong in that the analogy is false, that the Palestinians who were living in Kuwait, many of them for decades, were in fact long-term foreign residents. They were not people expelled from their own homes or from their homeland, which is the case of the 390 or 400-odd, as they originally were, who were expelled from the Israeli-occupied territories in late January. On the issue as to whether the other Arab governments themselves are hypocritical because they're also fighting an Islamist threat, that indeed is the case. And there is some sneaking sympathy, of course, for the Egyptians and the fact that they're battling at the moment with some extremely violent small Islamic groups. I think in that particular sense, the Israelis feel that they're winning a propaganda battle by showing that one has to be firm where the region-wide threat of political Islam is at stake. With the Egyptians, though, we feel equally that the Egyptian government is going about it the wrong way, and that a more appropriate method is inclusion rather than exclusion, to bring in the more moderate groups among the Islamists who are not committed to violence.
Well, what a lot of Israelis say is that, well, what can you expect Israel to do? It is under attack from the inside and from the outside. What is it to do about people inside of Israel who would like to destroy the whole state of Israel?
Not necessarily to expel them from their own regions. After all, Israel does not lay claim, or at least most Israelis do not lay claim, to the Israeli-occupied territories of the West Bank and Gaza. What they should do, in fact, is to use what they are already doing, is the full force of the law against such people. They have the means to be able to lock them up for very many years. Certainly, they have an adequate security apparatus that gives them the means to do so.
Middle East Watch has said that in the long run, human rights violations strengthens the popular appeal of extremist groups. How have you seen that work?
We've seen it in Egypt. I think that's a very good example of the way in which the way of the Egyptian security services in interrogating people, the use of torture against them, the shortcuts in the legal process. Just in the last few days, we've seen that a large group of Islamists in Egypt have been put before a military court rather than a civilian court. The same thing had happened in Algeria and in Tunisia. If people see that specific methods are being used against them as a particular group that's attempting to protest, some of them violent, some of them non-violent, but they're being condemned by association, they will feel less and less inclined to be able to go through the normal constitutional processes in the country to be able to seek change through means other than violence. And the Egyptian Islamist groups have been very specific about it. They have said quite clearly that fire will be answered by fire.
I want to ask you about Israel's occupation of the West Bank and the Gaza Strip. Is Human Rights Watch and Middle East Watch opposed to the occupation in general?
No, we're not. We simply don't enter into that discussion. It's inappropriate for us to do so. We don't take issue on the very political question of occupation. We don't speak about the rights of a country to occupy another or what its legal position is here. This would be entering into the political arena, and I think we'd be undermining our credibility if we were to do so. What we do is to say that we recognize that even though 26 years have lapsed since 1967, that there are certain laws that still apply there, and the principal one is the Fourth Geneva Convention, which covers occupied territory. The Hague Convention of 1907, which the Israelis do recognize, also applies there. So we attempt to hold a region, and that includes East Jerusalem, even though it's been annexed by Israel, up to certain standards of behavior by the Israelis. And I think that is still the best way to go.
Andrew Whitley, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Andrew Whitley is the director of the human rights group Middle East Watch. This is Fresh Air. The Clinton administration is reviewing its policy on Bosnia. Robert Siegel's with us. Robert, what do you have on that, on All Things Considered?
Well, we'll hear what President Clinton said in his news conference today, where he was asked a few times about how he might review policy, what he might think about airstrikes or lifting the arms embargo against the Bosnians. The president gave very little idea of what his administration might do, but we'll also hear about those reports that State Department officials and his UN ambassador, Madeleine Albright, have recommended a change away from current policy towards something more anti-Serb. We'll also be hearing today from two Roman Catholic writers, Michael Novak and George Weigel, about the role they say the church played, a central role in the fall of communism in Central Europe.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz singer Ella Fitzgerald turned 75 this Sunday. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says he listens to Fitzgerald far more than any other singer or musician these days, even when he should be listening to something else. He has an appreciation.
Ella Fitzgerald turns 75 Sunday, and I hope she sits around all day with her feet up on the good furniture while people tell her how terrific she is, or how terrific both Ellas are. It's almost like there are two Ella Fitzgeralds, either of which ranks among the great jazz artists ever. One is the singer of ballads and standards who always puts the song first. The other is the superhuman scat singer who remakes any tune into her own creation. Here's Fitzgerald in 1947.
Oh, lady, oh, lady, oh, lady, be good to me.
That's the Ella Fitzgerald most people know, thanks to those old and much parodied Memorex commercials where she'd shatter glass with a high note. There is an air of stunt work about her virtuoso improvising and patented routines, but the thrills are always musical. Singing this fast isn't easy. Doing it in tune is amazing. By the way, that's from a good 2-CD survey of her Decca recordings from the late 30s to the mid-50s, called 75th Birthday Celebration. It's one of the many Ella reissues we're being blessed with this year, and since her Decca stuff has been hard to come by lately, it's especially welcome. But Fitzgerald's great period begins just after this, when she moved to the Verve label and began her series of songbook albums, each devoted to the work of a great American composer like Gershwin or Berlin. The crisp articulation she brings to scatting serves her well singing lyrics, too. And as she approached age 40, her vocal timbre deepened and became more attractive, till she possessed one of the most beautiful voices of any singer. If you want to hear a perfect marriage of voice and material, listen to either volume of her Harold Arlen songbook. That's as good as it gets. These lyrics are by Ira Gershwin.
The road gets rougher, it's lonelier and tougher. With hope you burn up, tomorrow he may turn up. There's just no let up, the live long night and day. Ever since this world began, there is nothing sadder than a one-man woman looking for the man that got away.
It's no wonder Harold Arlen loved the way Fitzgerald sang his tunes, even on other occasions when she'd tinker with the melody. Ella knows the first rule in such cases is to do no harm, and her changes tend to enrich a tune or make it more lilting. Now, you might expect a singer of such formidable talent to be full of self-importance, but Ella Fitzgerald doesn't take herself too seriously. Here she is at a Berlin concert in 1960, blanking out on the words to a current pop hit.
Someone sneaking.
Probably safe to say Ella Fitzgerald is America's most beloved entertainer. Who's the competition? Bob Hope? Tom Arnold? Come on. Speaking for all Americans, Ms. Fitzgerald, we love you. Happy birthday.
Kevin Whitehead is a jazz critic in New York. There are two new Ella Fitzgerald reissues, the 75th birthday celebration, the Decca recordings on GRP, and First Lady of Song on Verve. I'm Terry Gross.
Mr. Paganini, we breathlessly await your masterful baton gone and singing. If the boys are bopping, ain't no need in stopping. Disket attached, I lost my yellow basket. Bop, beep, beep, bada you do be. Heard your repertoire, and at the final bar, we greeted you with round applause. What a great ovation your interpretation, Bob Do-do, would do. Listen, Paganini, now don't you be a meanie. What have you up your sleeve? Come on and spring.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Indian writer Amitav Ghosh about attacks against Muslims in India by Hindu fundamentalists. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.